Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi everyone, Connor Boyle here. Just a reminder, you can take your Intelligence Squared experience deeper with Intelligence Squared Premium. You'll get an ad-free feed, one early episode per week, two bonus episodes per month, discounts on Intelligence Squared Plus, priority access to our live in-person events, and access to our premium monthly newsletter. Sign up at iq2premium.supercast.com. Thanks for all your support. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. On the show today, Bruce Daisley, the writer, tech insider, podcaster, and expert on all things related to how we work, joins us to discuss his most recent book, Fortitude, Unlocking the Secrets of Inner Strength. Our host for today's discussion is Sarah Ellis. Sarah is co-founder of Amazing If, an award-winning company with a mission to make careers better for everyone. She's also the co-host of the Squiggly Careers podcast, along with Helen Tupper, and the two have published books, including You Coach You. Here's Sarah with more.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to today's conversation. So welcome to this Intelligence Squared event with Bruce Daisley. I will give Bruce a proper introduction in a moment, but I've known Bruce for a couple of years, and there's a few things that you can always feel guaranteed by whenever you spend time with Bruce. You'll come away a bit smarter, a bit wiser, and he will definitely make you smile, even though he's always more than prepared to disagree with me. So hopefully it'll be a really fun conversation to be part of. And as well as me asking Bruce some questions and hopefully some tough questions along the way, and then we'll go over to the audience questions, or feel free to keep them anonymous if you'd prefer. Ask Bruce some hard questions. He likes a hard question. A few things about Bruce if you're coming across him for the first time today, or perhaps you're new to his work. He's the author of now two Sunday Times best-selling books. His first is called The Joy of Work, and then we've got Fortitude that we're going to be talking about today. Previously, he was the European Vice President of Twitter, and he hosts a brilliant podcast called Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat that I'd really recommend anyone who's interested just in work and culture of work. He has incredible guests, and he brings his inquiring mind to those conversations. And he's also one of Evening Standard's 1,000 Most Influential Londoners for 4 years, so he obviously just keeps being influential. And so tonight we're going to be diving into his new book, Fortitude. So Bruce, shall we dive in and get started?
Yeah, thank you so much. Looking forward to it.
So at the very start of Fortitude, I think it's in the first chapter or so, there was a sentence that sort of really stopped me in my tracks and made me rethink resilience, which is one of the things that I think Fortitude does so well. And you say, never in the history of resilience has someone become more resilient by being told to be more resilient. And as soon as you sort of wrote that sentence, I thought, oh yeah, we can't just be more resilient, especially in those moments of adversity and those tough times. And I thought that was a good starting point for our discussion today, is let's sort of dive into what are some of the problems with resilience. Why does resilience perhaps hinder rather than help us? What gets in the way when we kind of use resilience as our starting point?
But the funny thing is, it's like resilience is, it's just everywhere around us. And it's one of those things, you know, if you find yourself in a circumstance, you know, pregnant women always report seeing pregnant women everywhere. As soon as you're aware of the word resilience, you start spotting the use of it everywhere. I was listening to the radio a couple of weeks ago, and it was used about three times in a row, 2 days running on Radio 4 Today program. It's like really interesting that it just permeates the discourse, because I think it's just such an easy thing to demand of someone, you know, deal with it. be more resilient, suck it up, be stronger, because it kind of enables you to feel like I gave them some advice, I sent them on their way, and it's not my problem anymore. Now, I know that in the majority of instances, it's got a more charitable use to that. You know, we're saying it to try and say to a teenager, look, you know, you're going to need to toughen up, or saying it to a friend, you know, you need to be more resilient. We're not deliberately trying to say something that's unhelpful, but it's been very heavily misappropriated. I found myself, I started writing this right sort of at the start of COVID, and then you weren't allowed to see people for 5 or 6 months. And so I'm 5 months into writing a book on resilience. And then when you're allowed to see people, I met up with people, eat out to dine out to eat, help out. And I met up with people saying, oh, I'm writing what have you been doing during COVID? I've written a book on resilience. And they're like, oh, okay, I'm really fed up of hearing about resilience. Good, that's helpful. And, well, you know, I've got a friend who sort of says, you know, everyone here has been sent on resilience course, and people roll their eyes when it's mentioned. And it was like, okay, well, this actually is pretty consistent with the angle I'm coming from. But a lot of people are getting very fed up of the R word, I think. And I wanted to unpick why actually, in its essence, something that should be helpful, a helpful pointer for us, why is it sort of being misappropriated and losing all the energy from it?
And one of the things that actually I don't think you necessarily dive into in that much detail in Fortitude is almost the difference between fortitude and resilience. So I wonder if we could just pause on that for a moment before we move on to some of the kind of chapter topics, because I always feel like, certainly through the work that I do, the words that we use matter. They frame our thinking, they give us references, they can really help us in a positive way, or they can be barriers. So is the conclusion that you've come to that fortitude is just a better word for resilience? So are they sort of more synonymous, or do you see them as being actually different things? Because you do, in fortitude, you've really gone into the research. You've taken research from lots of different areas of, you know, whether it's psychology or sociology. You've not sort of just stayed in a silo in one area. So I was just interested to see where you've got to with this relationship between resilience and fortitude. Do you want us to stop using the word resilience, or is it just you want us to understand it better?
Not really. And in fact, I use it all the time. But it's more, you know, if you have got a weariness about it, then giving yourself the opportunity to have a reset. You know, the thing is, because it's been so heavily misappropriated, you'll still walk into a workplace and they'll have a poster up for a resilience workshop. And I guess I just wanted to have something that was a mental reset from that, something that was saying, okay, that's well established, but I just want to maybe come at it a slightly different way. And, you know, broadly, it was an attempt to, you know, I hate those books where you read it and it feels like the title is capitalized all the way through. Grit really springs to mind. If you've ever read Angela Duckworth's Grit, it feels like not only is she establishing this idea, but she's also trying to trademark it. It's almost like needs the little TM after every time she's using it. And I was really conscious not to do that. So, you know, while I much prefer this opportunity to think again about the way we're doing it, you know, for me, fortitude and resilience are synonyms. But I think it's a way to try and say, okay, we're actually thinking about it in this slightly different way. And so fortitude is the refresh on that, really.
Yeah, and I think one of my observations is you definitely resist the temptation, and it is a temptation, I think, for anyone who writes a book to come up with a formula for fortitude. And I think you even have a great quote in the book where you talk about, you know, well, something that is complex, you can't simplify it and just go, well, this is the answer. You just do this one thing and it's a silver bullet. I do think you explore it from lots of angles. And one of the things that's really interesting, and I think you've maybe even got a chapter title that talks to this, is that phrase that we're all really familiar with, which is, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And we sort of all feel that, and this sense of, well, if I've been through lots of adversity or I've been through lots of hardship, I found things really difficult, does that increase my resilience? Is that actually useful for me for later in life? Is that why some people go on to be super performers in whatever their field might be? And you definitely challenge that that notion. So I wonder if you could just talk to us a little bit about this idea of what doesn't kill us perhaps very nearly kills us, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, there's a really critical part to this, that firstly, there's so much survivor's bias in the stories that we're told. And so we see these stories of people who've achieved remarkable things, and to some extent we're sort of given an explanation that we might take to believe is the thing that explains what's gone on. So, you know, specifically, let's look at a story that was in the news 3 or 4 weeks ago. Mo Farah, one of the greatest track and field athletes the UK has ever produced, 2 gold medals from 2 successive games. And actually now, in context of the new explanation he's given for his childhood, we might say, well, wow, you know, what didn't kill him made him stronger. He was inspired to go on and achieve this greatness through this childhood adversity. You know, he was victim of human trafficking. And actually, I wanted to really get to the bottom of that, because there's some intriguing evidence that might serve to misdirect you along the way. UK Sport did this now really intriguing piece of research that didn't get a lot of publicity at all. You know, I searched for newspaper articles about this when it first came out, and there was 1 or 2 small pieces pulled out, but it wasn't well covered. UK Sport did this piece of work when they were being gifted some more money from government. I think there was a recognition that actually sporting achievement from 2012 onwards seemed to correlate with national pride and a sense of shared identity. So more money was going into it. And UK Sport said, we don't want to go this alone. We want to try and understand where we should put our money. Because sometimes they were investing in athletes and they were going to the games and getting a gold, and they were investing in other athletes and they would disappear without a trace. It was like, okay, well, our job is backing winners, so how do we find the winners? And this piece of research is fascinating to look at. It's about 120 pages long, and they look into the biographies of retired British athletes. And they say these people, by their accomplishments, are household names. So they anonymize them. They don't tell you who they are, but there's a remarkable story that runs through it. All of these household names, these super elite athletes, all of them, 100% of them, reported a significant moment of childhood trauma, a significant moment of a negative experience, normally correlated around the same time with a significant moment of sporting success. Now, that's really intriguing. To contrast them with those who went to the games and didn't get golds, only 1/4 of them had something comparable. So it's this really interesting story because, okay, now we look at the Mo Farah story and we don't look at it as this redemption sequence that's one-off. We look at it and we go, oh, there's something intriguing going on here. There's something fascinating, that something has somehow played a part. And so firstly, I wanted to go in and disabuse any mistaken idea that we might have. I posted a TikTok and someone replied about Mo Farah's story, and someone replied, oh, it makes me sad that I didn't have any childhood trauma. And so this is an attempt, what I do in that chapter is an attempt to go into actually, firstly, how well we now understand the impact of childhood trauma and how it has hugely harmful impact on human lives. So, you know, there's something called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Index. And this is a really simple, rudimentary way to appraise people's experience. It was discovered by a couple of American physicians. They put it together because they were starting to recognize really interesting patterns. Very briefly, a guy called Vincent Felitti, Dr. Vincent Felitti, he discovered that when he was running a weight loss clinic, people who were generally 200, 300 pounds, and he was trying to get them down to a normal weight, he stumbled upon the discovery that 55% of his patients who were extremely obese had suffered childhood sexual abuse. He was astonished. He didn't believe that that had any frequency to it at all. He thought it was a freak aberration. And he discovered that actually it was the thing that characterized a lot of his patients. Astonishing and alarming. The two physicians took that work and they built this index, this Adverse Childhood Experience Index. And it's a really helpful device because it enables you to go through 10 things, and some of them are very different in terms of their gravity. Some of them, one of them is, did your parents divorce before you're 18? Another one is, were you sexually abused? I mean, like they feel polar opposites. But the interesting thing is that parental abuse very strongly correlates with childhood obesity. Were you humiliated? initiated routinely as a kid very strongly correlates with people who spend time in jail and have sort of histories of violent behaviour. And what you find is that because you don't have to tell someone which ones you ticked yes or no to, you're given a score. And this ACE score is astonishing as a vehicle for telling us life outcomes, if left unchecked, life outcomes. So if you've got an ACE score of 4, you're 33 times more likely to have educational problems at school. If you've got an ACE score of 4, and I've got an ACE score of 4, you're twice as likely to suffer from heart disease. You're twice as likely to suffer from cancer. About 60 to 70% of all addiction issues are explained by ACE scores. If you have an ACE score of 7, and the US prison population on average have an ACE score of 6, if you have an ACE score of 7, your life expectancy is 20 years lower. So look, we've got these two really interesting things juxtaposed. Firstly, these elite athletes seem to have reached a level of transcendence from their negative experiences. And secondly, in aggregate, that is not the way that elite, yeah. The abuse and negative experience play out. And so it's this really interesting juxtaposition that I wanted to get to the heart of. What were the things going on here, and how can we understand the mechanisms at play in something as hard to understand as the human brain?
And as you started to dive into that, I think one of the things that surprised me the most and got a lot of underlining as I was reading Fortitude is you start to make the distinction and talk about the difference between the way you describe it is meanness versus weeness when it comes to resilience and fortitude, because I think our assumption and our inclination and even in what you've just described is this is a solo endeavor. Like, how can I be more resilient? Or I'm not resilient enough if I'm beating myself up, or if we're having a difficult time, we're thinking I need to be more resilient. Whereas actually you talk about this idea of we can collectively be resilient and how powerful that is. And you reference a social scientist, Emile Durkheim, who talks about this idea of collective effervescence, which I thought was just a lovely phrase. So I wonder if you could just talk about this idea of, again, because I feel like one of the things the book does so well is debunk some very commonly held myths or sayings that we have about resilience that probably do get in our way. And I feel like this is alongside this idea of, oh, you know, I need to have gone through lots of adversity to be very successful, which clearly isn't true. Like you say, there are some outlier examples and we know them because they're very well known and well publicised. There's also this sense of, oh, well, this is an individual thing. And so what examples did you come across or what evidence did you find as part of writing Fortitude that this could be something that we could think about together, maybe as a team or as a community in terms of where you live, or perhaps as a community of people who've got a similar interest, or you want to support people who perhaps need support, especially with where we are at the moment in the world. So what's the difference between those two? And are there any examples or stories that might bring those things to life?
Yeah, well, look, you know, if I was going to summarize the one thing from the work that I did was that, you know, if I wanted to be reductive and say, you know, what is the lesson? Mm-hmm. The lesson is that resilience is the strength we draw from each other. Resilience is a collective strength. Resilience is the way that together, all of us are stronger than any of us. And I think, you know, that's my fundamental finding on it. So, you know, the one thing that is everywhere, ubiquitous in the world of work right now is these resilience webinars. And I think probably the question that I would pose to any manager commissioning a resilience workshop is absolutely, you know, understanding that you've got a need for it is really critical. But one of the things you might ask yourself is not how do I demand resilience from my workforce, but how can you enable it in them? How can you make them feel supported and really sort of part of a movement? How can we all feel like we're all in it together? And you see really fascinating examples of that. These are an incredible American social scientist who passed away a couple of years ago called Enrico Quarantelli. And he was fascinating because his job really was to travel in the opposite lanes of traffic when a natural disaster has taken place. So, you know, all the lanes of traffic are clogged with cars fleeing an earthquake, some sort of 9/11, you know, something that's bad that's happened. He's the lone car driving in the other direction. He wanted to go and see what was going on. And he describes really really interesting things. When he was first doing the work, he was expecting that when you went into a natural disaster, you would see all these forlorn people dashing for the hills, really anxious. He said he was so certain that that was what he was looking for. He kept looking for it. He's like, I can't find this anywhere. And then he started, in the end, he got commissioned by the US government to do his work because he was just really providing some counterintuitive evidence. And one thing they found was that almost without exception, there was something that happened in the midst of natural disasters. Images from Pakistan right now really bring this to mind, that, you know, irrespective of whether you are a businessman that owns this luxury mansion or you're someone who lives in this sort of rather more humble dwelling down the road, you're all in this moment where your old identities have been reset. You know, you really vividly see this in the first-hand accounts of people from things like September the 11th, where people would say, these lovely stories where people say, we all walked down the length of Manhattan, bars just started opening, and, you know, I bought this stranger a beer and we stood contemplating the world. And these really interesting moments where people sort of forget who we used to be and now imagine who we are. And all of that is in service, I think, to this idea that fortitude, strength seems to come when we've got this sense that we're all in it together, that when we're all united by something that we share with each other. And I think for me, that's number one, it's a really critical lesson. And secondly, it's got a very valuable application to the moment of work, of society that we're all in right now.
And actually just building on that in terms of kind of the nowness, one of the things that you talk about is that whenever we are faced universally, something I think we universally all have in common, is whenever we have uncertainty, a lack of information and a loss of control, it leads to stress inevitably, and I would imagine a reduction in resilience or a potential reduction in resilience. And I was thinking about where we all are in the world right now, and you know, if you were doing a checklist, like, do you feel some uncertainty about the future? You'd be thinking yes. Lack of information. Do you really feel like you know? If things feel transparent. Are the known knowns all there? You're probably like no. Do I feel really in control of my energy prices? No. You know, that list kind of goes on, whether you look at it from in terms of your world or the world. All of those three things are probably present for most people to at least some extent. And so I just wondered whether, given that's probably true for most people listening or watching this right now, what are some of the things that you think might be useful for people to do, either together or individually? Because I think there were still some examples in Fortitude about, yes, there's a real sense of togetherness here that can be very useful, but there are also some things you can do individually. So it's not a kind of an either or, it's more of an and, was certainly the sense that I got. So if that is how people are feeling, you know, pretty bruised after the past couple of years, and then it feels pretty relentless right now. That's the kind of the word that I'm hearing from, you know, my sisters on our WhatsApp group or my friends. You know, it just feels like kind of wave after wave. What can we do to sort of help each other and to help ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, you know, I think there's a critical part to this. And I mentioned before those workplaces that are commissioning resilience training. And probably one of the first things that is worth understanding is the importance of a sense of personal control and our well-being is fundamental. It's one of the biggest predictors of how we're doing. You know, I guess if you put control at one end and helplessness at another, you know, the closer we feel to helpless, the worse our overall sense of well-being, especially our mental well-being. And I think this comes out really vividly if we think about the lived experience of a lot of employees, a lot of people in the workforce right now, like teammates, ourselves. If you open your calendar on a Monday morning and it's back-to-back meetings, or you open it on Sunday night, if you want a glimpse at what horrors await you tomorrow morning, and you've got back-to-back meetings, you can sort of imagine it does produce this anxiety, this spiraling anxiety where people are like, oh my God, we're back in the relentless cycle again. We're back at it again. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I've witnessed from a lot of people that, you know, I sort of every week I try to document a few things that are happening and evolving in the workplace in a newsletter. And one of the things that I often observe is that I speak to people and they say, you know, I just feel completely overwhelmed and out of control. I feel like, you know, there's never enough moments in a day to get work done. or, you know, the horror of, look, this is as bad as it's ever been, and now the boss is demanding we're in 3 days a week. You know, every time I've been into the office, I'm getting less done, not more done. I feel I feel like I've got no control over this. And it's a really big predictor. And in fact, it's sort of, it's this predictor that it seems fairly easy to mediate. There was a piece of work published a couple of months ago that said that when you give workers a day with no meetings, their sense of stress goes down, their sense of engagement with their job goes up. And, you know, that can be a really simple thing. It's not saying that they won't meet anyone that day, but it's just like there's no scheduled calendar meetings. They can feel free to arrange any of their meetings themselves. So it's like a really interesting thing, just giving people a tiny bit more control, a tiny bit more autonomy over their lives seems to have a huge, disproportionately strong effect, I think, on people feeling like they can cope.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And we've experimented with that, so I can talk about that firsthand. So we have in Amazing If, our company, something called Freedom Fridays, where it doesn't have to be a Friday, but we call it Freedom Fridays because we remember it and it sort of has the alliteration that's quite useful. And on Freedom Fridays, exactly to your point, it's completely up to you if you want to meet somebody, but the sort of the day is yours. You sort of design that day, and it just feels like that day always feels different. Some people decide to do it on a Tuesday. I actually do it on a Friday. And it just means that your sort of your sense of autonomy and control actually over the whole of the week feels different. Right. I think the sort of the halo effect of the sort of resilience and strength that you feel, it's almost sort of from one intervention, the ripple of that goes across the whole of your week. Not just, you don't just sort of feel good that day and then not very good the other 3 or 4 days. Actually, you feel kind of everything rises. You kind of feel better generally. And anything I think you can do to experiment from a, certainly from a work perspective with what could we do differently and not feeling like you have to come up with all the answers. Certainly if you're watching this as a leader or a manager, the best organisations certainly that we work with at the moment are very much asking people, what could this look like? How what could we experiment with? What would be useful for you? And so involve people rather than feeling like you have to solve for people, which again, I think increases people's control. So again, you get that extra benefit by including people in those conversations.
It sounds amazing, but how do you do it if someone chooses Tuesday and someone chooses Friday? Because surely they do need to meet each other. How do you make that work?
I think what we found, I mean, we're a small company, which right. I think is right. easier. I guess when I used to work for a very, very, very big companies, we did have days where people sort of tried to do half a day a week where, you know, it was sort of universal. So we're smaller. So I guess that works a bit easier. And we've got people doing quite different sorts of jobs. Some of those are more reliant on meeting people than others and different types of meeting. There's quite a big difference between a 10-minute conversation and maybe a meeting with an external client. So at the moment, I mean, we're still very much in experimenting phase. We've probably been doing it for 4 months. So who knows? Who knows how it will work? But so far, the feedback has been good. So it is quite interesting. Is there anything you've done differently, Bruce? Before we go to questions from other people, and please do keep those conversations coming. I can already see some of those questions, so I do want to get to those. But you know, you writing a book is a it's a kind of all inclusive process. It's a good way to think of it. You will have dived so deep into the world of research around resilience. You tell some great stories and give loads of examples in Fortitude to really bring the ideas to life. What has it made you think about your life and the way that you work? Have you changed anything? Have you done things differently as a result?
Yeah, the thing that's really, you know, if I've talked about sort of resilience is the strength we draw from other people, it's made me value and actually evaluate my friendships and the groups I'm part of more than ever before. You know, I might have mentioned it to you or someone, but I did an exercise vaguely where I scribbled down like all of the friendships. It's in this book that in front of me just by coincidentally of all the friendships and all the groups that I feel part of. And in fact, I'm in the midst of arranging a work reunion with another group because it just made me feel like, oh, wow, you know, that connection is such a valuable part of us feeling human and supportive and like we're not doing this alone. And so it made me, firstly, evaluate them. And then secondly, by the very act of evaluating what friendships you've got and what groups you're part of, it's made me think, okay, well, what efforts are you making to get those into a better place than they were 6 months ago. I don't want to say that that's the exclusion of new friends. One of my very best friends is someone I've only known really for 3 or 4 or 5 years. But it's just made me really value connection with other people in a way that I was casually aware of before, mm-hmm. but I'm very vividly aware of now. And it's just, fundamentally, it's made me change that.
And that's perhaps unexpected. You know, that's perhaps not what you would have thought at the start of the process.
Yeah.
So let's go to some of these questions because I've had a quick read through and they are brilliant questions and also really quite a range of questions. So I think we'll go in different places. So the first conversation question comes from Steve and he says, we are told that children who show grit in early life tend to be more successful later on. Is there any correlation between the way children deal with adversity and how they handle it later on in life?
You know, grit very much sits as part of what I labelled the resilience orthodoxy. And so at great length, I went through what is claimed about grit and the methodology that they do. Maybe too long, but I just want to go and get to the heart of it. And you know, I'd really take issue with most of what's there. Firstly, there's some significant issues in whether what is claimed about it is actually true. But, you know, even to the extent that some of the research, I don't think proves what the researcher claims. Secondly, I think, you know, even the author of it, Angela Duckworth, she worked on the original paper with a guy called Martin Seligman. But even she would claim that the thing that she values in her work is the ability to stick at things irrespective of other interests and to the exclusion of everything else. And I'm not convinced that that's necessarily a good recipe for success in the year 2022 or 2020 or 2032 or 2042. You know, we need to be adaptable. We need to be flexible. There's some really intriguing evidence about when people persist at things, even when they're not necessarily good at them, it can have a pretty harmful effect on their well-being. So I think the lesson has to be a bit more adaptable than that. It has to be that, you know, give something a good go, persist at it, try your best. But if it's not for you, then learning something that you are good at is an important trade-off, I think. So, you know, I spend a long time going through grit. Grit is probably right in the bullseye of the things that I was most intrigued about because you hear it everywhere. In the US, it was described as like, in schools, it was described as like a semi-religion. Mm-hmm. And so there's been so much endorsement of it. And, you know, I went a great length through the papers that have sort of reviewed it and appraised it, really.
Hi, everyone. It's Connor Boyle here. If you don't already know, we've launched Intelligence Squared Premium. It's an exciting new way to take your Intelligence Squared experience to the next level so you can make the most informed decisions about the issues that matter in the company of the world's greatest minds and speakers. Crucially, it lets us produce even more amazing podcasts for you, as well as running some more live events and big debates. This is now available on all podcast players, including Spotify, for just $4.99 a month. Sign up now at iq2premium.supercast.com. That's IQ, the numeral 2, premium.supercast.com, or see the link in the description. Thank you for all your support. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Okay, so that's interesting on schools. So let's skip to a question on schools, and I promise I will come back to some of the others because I think this is connected. Becky in Beverly is asking, do you think that schools should create a more cooperative style of learning to prepare young people for the world of work and life? So you talked about that we-ness. So is this something that we could imagine, you know, creating an opportunity to learn in schools? Can you see how some of the work that you've done could apply in that kind of setting?
Yeah, most definitely. If you think about, you know, I think the reason why so many Gen Zs are arriving in the workforce and thinking work is mad, work is just dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Why do I have to keep doing this job that I'm not very well paid for 10 years before I reach that level and 20 years before I reach that level? Just why does it work like this? I think the reason why they're arriving in the workforce thinking about those things is that we're just setting people up so inexpertly for the world we're going into. Actually, you know, maybe to some extent their questioning mind is more adapted to the moment we're in than the people who are incumbents in the workforce. But I think, I think there's a lot of lessons to learn. Not least, there's some fascinating evidence about what teenagers can be helped with. You know, I was very aware that when you talk about resilience and when you talk about the notion of people being stronger, that there's a constant suggestion that young people are less resilient than they used to be. So I spend a lot of time going through that. And look, you know, it's worth saying that I think I'm even-handed in the way I look at some of this. Probably the world's leading expert on teenage mental well-being is a woman called Jean Twenge. And Jean Twenge from University of San Diego looks at teenagers trying to understand, are they less able to cope than the cohort of people maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago? And, you know, what she strongly believes that mobile phones have had an impact. But one of the things that I think she was surprised by was some evidence that came at the start of the pandemic. And the pandemic really sort of gave us, you know, so many different periods of research. So the bit I'm asking you to think about and to try and reimagine is that first period you were watching the daily briefings. Chris Whitty was like the most important man in the UK. It was that first couple of months. Someone was being sent out to forage for toilet rolls. Someone was sort of gathering pasta shells, and you were gathering together at the dinner table every night and having a meal in maybe the only way, in a way that you've never encountered your flatmates, your family before. And that period she researched, and she found that teenagers who were having an evening meal each night were significantly less depressed and significantly more resilient than those who didn't. Resilience is togetherness. Fortitude is a feeling of connection. And actually, schools should be teaching that. There's some valuable lesson, I think, for schools to understand that when we feel, it's why so many of us have got a fond memory of school, because that moment of deep connectedness, that sort of real visceral connection with people around you, is quite an enduring experience. A lot of us walk away from it going, those were the best years of my life. And I think, you know, it's a really important lesson when we're thinking about what school can teach.
I certainly think if my five-year-old was taught that at school, I would feel pretty reassured about that, about his future. And like you say, I think when I think about some of my happiest memories of school, it's never me as an individual. My happiest memory is my, you know, my netball team winning the under 18 netball championship and, you know, coming from the school that I came from and that being very unexpected. You know, and that's a, like you say, that's a real visceral memory. I don't particularly remember anything sort of by myself or sitting and doing particularly, you know, well, or like, oh, I wrote a really good essay in English. Yeah, hopefully I wrote some good essays in English along the way, but that's not what you remember. A great question coming here from Julia, and I suspect Julia is not the only one with this question. She says, the boss of the company I work for is the kind of person who would be very resistant to your views. What can I do to help our team have more fortitude, given that the CEO is unlikely to come on board? So what might that look like?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I think we're presented with this everywhere. I wrote a book previously, which was about workplace culture. And really the inspiration for that was that anyone can change the culture. It's the boss doesn't own the culture. And, you know, I was particularly inspired by that, by going into one organization where the receptionist had changed the culture. And she'd said, you know, we've got a terrible culture here. And, you know, she'd taken it upon herself because no one had responded to that. So she'd gone out, she'd bought some bags of Doritos, she'd bought some, you know, multi-packs of Quavers. She laid them all out on a paper plate, on paper plates, and she invited people to Crisp Thursday. You know, this week we're going to be trying this week we're going to be trying Chinese flavoured snacks. This week we're going to be trying, you know, she introduced themes to it. And it became very quickly a part of a ritual of part of the organisation. People would say, are you going to Crisp Thursday? We don't need a meeting, I'll meet you at Crisp Thursday. Really interesting, the sort of playing out of those interactions. Anyway, so the thing I've always been struck by, I used to have a boss and we had this confounding problem that where we had loads of people quitting with no job to go to. And when we did exit interviews with people, they said it's because the culture is relentless. I have meetings in the evening, I have meetings all day, I have nonstop emails all weekend. And so we said, okay, so how about we were around the table, sort of senior leadership team, how about we try and stop weekend emails? And it's like, okay, well, it was like, well, because the people are telling us that's one of the biggest things. Okay, we'll give it a go. We'll give it a go for 3 months. Then, and so it was like trying to present the evidence to them to say, okay, if we've got the evidence, give it a go. And generally, I think evidence wins over opinion. And so that's why, you know, trying to say to someone, I think, you know, this is an interesting discussion, getting an article and saying, oh, you know, I'd love to get people's views on this article. I'd love to get people's views on this, you know, by all means, sort of get in touch with me and I'll give whoever this is and it's maybe something that I'll find from sort of a journal somewhere or an article somewhere that might be like for the next team offsite or, you know, to send anonymously to your boss, you know, package it up and say, look, you know, saw this and thought of you. But yeah, you know, it's in fact, when I did my old book, I did this little series, the book very much with that intention. I set up this little helpline called the Bad Boss Helpline.
I remember you like, doing that. Yeah.
And it was like, if you've got a bad boss, I will anonymously send a copy of the Joy of Work to your boss. and tell them that someone saw this and thought of you. And I had quite a few fun things come through on that.
As well as doing that, Julia, if it's helpful sometimes with the work that we do, so we do a lot of work on what's called squiggly careers. So, you know, careers where you develop in different directions and we're learning and adapting, very much sits alongside the work that Bruce does. Sometimes, again, we get CEOs who are not on board with that or, you know, maybe it feels unfamiliar. You know, they're used to the ladder-like world and the hierarchy. We also often find that, you know, external people who are credible or sources that don't come from within the organisation seem to have an overwhelmingly big impact. So, for example, when we write a Harvard Business Review article on reimagining retention, it's a very different thing for a CEO to read versus perhaps a HR director talking about that to a CEO who perhaps just feels like that person is, oh, that's the thing that they believe in. They're just trying to kind of put forward their own views. So sometimes finding external experts like Bruce and those sort of sources, I often try and figure out, well, what feels credible in that person's mind? It might be just as credible as exactly what you're saying, but it can just, you know, borrow some brilliance from somewhere else that might make the point, a different industry, a different person, in case that's helpful. Right, let's do a deep and meaningful question, Bruce, and then I've got another practical one for you. So Stella asks, are there any ancient thinkers who have inspired your own thinking? For example, Chinese, Greek or Roman thinkers?
You're presuming far too high a brow for me, really. I mean, it's interesting. I did go through, specifically when I was thinking about the suspicion of the young, you know, saying that the younger generation are less resilient than us before. I did go through these mentions of younger people being criticized in ancient Egypt, these criticisms of younger people in the Bible, criticisms going back to sort of 14th, 15th century. So those things are recurrent, actually. And in fact, even if you ask psychologists, so if you ask trained people who are expert on this, and you say to them, do you think young people are better today at the marshmallow challenge than they were 20 years ago? So the marshmallow challenge is where you offer a marshmallow to a preschooler, and you say to them, you can have one marshmallow now or two in 5 minutes' time. And the question, it's much debated whether this is predictive of anything, let alone adult success. But if you ask psychologists, do you think kids today are better than they were 30 years ago? And they say, no, I bet they're significantly worse. Kids have been getting better at this challenge for the last 30 years. So we just, even people who are trained in it underestimate people. But no, I have no wisdom that originates really, my work sort of focuses on the research for the last 20 years, really.
And just one other one, we're in that kind of deep, thoughtful questions, because I don't want to ignore it before we move on to another one. Jamal is asking, religious people tend to live longer and happier lives. Do you see any parallels between your collaborative approach to success and that of religious groups?
Absolutely. There's a really intriguing thing. And look, you know, I don't mean to question the value of the religion in itself, but one of the things that you generally get from religious people is there's a very strong sense of we-ness, of connectedness. So, you know, one of the things you might say that religious people live longer, are you looking at the benefit of being part of a group, or are you looking at the protective glow of religion? And there's a really interesting phrase used by the former chief rabbi. So, you know, someone in Judaism. And he said, really interestingly, when he was reflecting, he's passed away now, but when he was reflecting on the history of the Jewish people, he said that there's something that was really important in terms of their identity being passed along, because they often, for a long time, obviously, they didn't have a country. And their identity was passed along by these shared moments of joy. Simha is the word he used for it. These moments of joy were really important for transferring a sense of who they were, what they stood for. And so it's just a really interesting reminder. I'll give you another that's a secular application away from religion. So quite often, you know, we'll hear of, oh, granny's joined a exercise class and, you know, it's really good for her, it's whatever. A group of researchers looked into trying to unpick exactly what was going on when granny and granddad joined the aerobics class. And so they created another class. You know, let's imagine it's in the next room. But this room was instructed that you could do a group activity, but it couldn't be a physical activity. So they actually set up a series of these groups, and this one was a reminiscence class. So the group would gather exactly the same time as the aerobics class on a Thursday morning, and they measured the health and well-being of both groups, and they showed identical improvements. You might beg the question, is the fact that you're in an aerobics group the protective thing rather than the aerobics itself? And probably the best way to summarize it is that a really famous American social scientist, a guy called Robert Putnam, he said, if you're not a member of a group, but you smoke 15 cigarettes a day, I would suggest you start grouping before you start quitting. Join a group because it's more protective of your health and your well-being than giving up the cigarettes. Intriguing thought, you know, that should be so beneficial.
That's so interesting at a very practical level, to kind of take it down to something very sort of straightforward. I remember when I read about shared moments of joy, and when you first, I read it first when you were writing your proof of your book. One of the things that we started doing in our company is doing a look forward to list. So we now publish in Amazing Earth a look forward to list every 3 months, because it's essentially, we're finding it's both anticipating moments of joy and having the moments of joy that is working wonders for our team, because we're a fully remote team. So we get together for, you know, very purposeful tasks and, you know, things that we need to achieve. But one of the things that we recognized is shared moments of joy for us as an organization are not going to happen just naturally through some drinks after work or, you know, in the kind of that old school office that I definitely grew up in. You know, people have got different lifestyles, different places they live, different commitments. And so we wanted to kind of create the chance for that sense of belonging, but to happen in a sort of low-key way. And that look forward to list is a really simple thing that we've done. We do it seasonally. We sort of have an autumn one and a winter one. And it has really surprised me, the positive reaction from the team. We've not even done some of the activities yet. They're just excited about those activities. And it's sort of created a shared moment of joy, even having the look forward to list. That was from reading your book, Bruce. We did that.
Amazing.
So an interesting one here, an anonymous one. More about, I think, wanting to get your perspective on a challenge again at work around women hitting the glass ceiling, particularly when they have kids. So often I think it's very well documented that, you know, perhaps you feel like you're doing well with your career, you're developing, you're making really good progress. You have kids and it feels like that means you stall, or perhaps even you kind of backtrack or have to make some compromises that have not been your choice. So you're not sort of squiggling with success, as we would talk about it. You're having to kind of make some compromises that is not what you would choose. And this person is also saying that they had hoped it might be different for someone who they're related to who is 15 years younger, and they've experienced something very similar. So being made redundant by a male boss who has made lots of women redundant and brought in lots of men from perhaps previous companies. And so I wondered whether, and you know, this person is sort of describing, I suspect, something that wouldn't feel unfamiliar for lots of people. So if you follow Pregnant Then Screwed on LinkedIn, and I'd encourage you to follow them on Instagram, there are lots of stories and examples that are very similar to that one that I've just read. And again, you can imagine those women being told, you know, you just need to be more resilient. You just need to suck it up or kind of live with it. And have you found any differences in terms of gender around resilience and fortitude and expectations in terms of what we expect from people? Is there anything else more broadly, actually zooming out in the work that you do about making work better? And that's the name of Bruce's brilliant newsletter, by the way, everybody, Make Work Better. Anything else that you have spotted that you think is just interesting to observe or comment on in response to that?
Yeah, I'll start with the second lens first, really, because I think, you know, the critical thing here is on that newsletter about a year and a half ago, I was given some data. Someone contacted me in Australia with some data that was about the return to office. So Australia had a very weird pandemic where initially they felt like they were teasing us by their concerts and their sporting events carrying on unabashed. And then they ended the pandemic with various cities that had the longest lockdowns in the world. So, you know, their pandemic was slightly inverted from ours. And in the midst of it, they had a return to the office. And this person contacted me with a series of data of which companies were going. We worked together on what the return to work policy was of these organizations. And then the data was the gender balance in those organizations. And we created an index of that was partly in Australia, any organization, I think over 50 people, needs to publish how many women they've got at every level of the organization. So it's this incredibly rich and textured take on exactly what their organisation looks like. Anyway, we correlated them together. And with the exception of one organisation, we looked at two industries. With the exception of one organisation, it was a straight line correlation. If you were returning to the office, you were far more likely to be a male-dominated firm. And it was astonishing, actually. The more women you had in the organisation, the more likely you were to have something that's progressive. It's a gendered issue. Even though it doesn't feel like the return to the office is a gendered issue, it is a gendered issue. The one outlier was an organisation that, albeit that didn't have the best gender balance, it had a female CEO. It's like, okay, I mean, like if I wanted something that proved the point. And it was a really fascinating piece of data. Like, it was eye-popping because you just thought, I cannot believe that, you know, the outcome that when we've run all of these, we've correlated it and we've got this astonishing straight line. And I think this is one of the things it's going to spring up. And we've kind of, because that knowledge is kind of there, we've banked it a little bit and we've forgotten it. So one of the things, there was an article in the New York Times today that I posted on LinkedIn and Twitter earlier that was, you know, an illustration of this. So the chief exec of one big famous American organization had looked at the Zoom logs of people on Fridays. And he decided that people weren't doing any work on Fridays because the Zoom logs were significantly lower. And so he's using it as a reason to demand people come back to the office. I'm not sure whether he's just going to demand they come back to the office on Fridays or just going to demand people come back to the office. But all of this is secretly a gendered thing, because the people who find it easier to come back to the office are people who don't have drop-off responsibilities, who don't have pick-up responsibilities, who don't have maybe care responsibilities on the periphery, who aren't dealing with this same volume of domestic work. And it's a gendered thing. You know, it's really and it's a quietly gendered thing. We've seen, in the US, 1 million women left the workforce during the pandemic. And while we don't have that depth of data here, it's a genuine issue. So I think, you know, this is far more a gendered issue. And in fact, you know, that question 2 questions ago about my boss won't believe in this, I guarantee that's a guy. I guarantee that, you know, there's certain people who the way that we're working has suited, and the historical way that we've got to here is suited, and they are trying to drop us with the University of Common Sense argument for why we need to go back to the way it was. You know, the way we're working wasn't working for a lot of people, and it's gaslighting, I think, to try and pretend that actually we were making a mistake in doing something more progressive, I think.
And so perhaps maybe it challenges what we've just talked about, but not necessarily. Somebody asking about connection at work, and I know you'll have a good point of view on this. So this person is asking anonymously, people change jobs a lot more frequently compared to 20 years ago. That's certainly true. Like, I know that from the work that we do. So people maybe stay in one job or maybe even one organisation for certainly one career for a shorter period of time than they did previously. Do you think that then means that people feel less connected at work? You know, there was a lot of talk, actually, this was pre-pandemic, about loneliness. You know, I remember we did some work on loneliness at work, and lots of people being in the office and feeling very lonely. So I think we've got to disconnect this idea of like, oh, well, you're less lonely if I'm sitting next to Bruce at a desk and we're both still tapping away or tapping on our laptops. So what are you seeing in terms of the work that you're doing in terms of this idea of connection? And does it link to this idea of like, we need to be in the office to be connected?
Look, I mean, there's no doubt a significant element of this. I think to some extent, we're moving from a relationship with work that is like our relationship with school to moving to something closer to our relationship with college. And what I mean by that is that our relationship at school was filled with constant connections with, you know, a group of people. It was tight knit. These represented your best friends. You know, they were your best friends. And, you know, these are the people that you remember for the rest of your life. At college, the people on your course might have been your friends, but there was pretty good chance that your real closest friends weren't studying on your course with you. You're unlikely to find a romantic partner on your course. You were unlikely to go out hanging out with them in the evenings. And I think we're moving to a closer relationship like that with work. It's gone from a school relationship to a college relationship. Now, that is not necessarily a bad thing. So work representing less of our identity, taking up less headspace for us is not a bad thing. But I think we just need to be mindful to make sure that we fill that gap. So if you don't have people that you're giggling with all day, you know, giggling is kind of something that got eliminated during the pandemic. But just like, you know, because you weren't around people all day, you weren't laughing in the same way. And I think as long as you feel it, you know, and you make sure that you're not living a life now devoid of laughter, you're trying to create those moments of fun and entertainment. I think there's no bad thing that work becomes less of our lives. But I think swapping out having those connections with not having them is probably a bad thing.
And just moving away from work, perhaps for our final question for today, somebody asking anonymously, do your ideas apply to family life as well as the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, the teenage thing, I think, is an illustration of that. Feeling connected to our family is really helpful for us. One of the things is really interesting when you look at the research about recovery from things like heart illness or depression. One of the things that's the best predictor of how well you'll recover, whether you have a recurrence of it, is how many groups you report feeling part of. And in a lot of that research, they count family as a group. You know, it does play a big part. They're often the people who understand us the best. They're there for us the most. So yeah, these things can be, having family can be really important. It's worth also putting on the record that for some people, their family does not represent that. So it's not a given, but if your family does feel like an enveloping, supportive, welcoming place, then definitely it can be that.
And if you wanted to leave everybody watching or listening with kind of a final few thoughts about fortitude, what are your final thoughts that you'd like to share with everybody?
Well, look, I want to thank you firstly, Sarah, for the amount of time that you've committed to doing this. I'm so immensely grateful and I'm in awe of the work that you and Helen do. So like, what an honor for you to do this with me. Look, you know, I think the thing that I would say is that I found myself scratching my head trying to work out why resilience was something that we evidently see it all around us, but whenever businesses try to synthesize it, it doesn't work. When classrooms try to create it, it doesn't work. So it exists in the wild, but it's kind of like panda babies. It's been hard to reproduce in captivity. And I think I wanted to get to the bottom of that, really, try and understand that. And the answer is right in front of our very eyes. You know, when we see people like, you know, people in surviving conflict, people who overcome remarkable situations, they never go it alone. Someone said in my research, you know, it's, you can't be resilient on your own, can you? And I think that's it. Resilience is the strength we draw from other people. And if we taught that to kids at school, if we taught that to colleagues who used to sit long side by side with each other, then it would make us feel less helpless and alone when we do feel like we're not at our best. So, you know, the strength that we draw from other people is probably a really potent lesson for all of us.
And a really lovely way to finish our conversation together. So thank you to Bruce. Thank you to all of you, to our audience. I know some people will be watching, listening live. Some people might be watching on catch up. And of course, to Intelligence Squared for hosting us today. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Just a reminder, you can support Intelligence Squared and get even closer to the world's most brilliant minds by signing up for Intelligence Squared Premium. For more information, go to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the description. Thank you for your support.